She smiled and kept working as he held the light, shining it where she told him to in her clipped diction. He had to lean in close enough that she could appreciate how long it had been since he had had a free moment to shower. She didn't recoil, however. After about 5 minutes, Mike got ready to leave.
"Keep the light," he said. "I need to get back topside. They're pulling the railgun turret, and it's a damn foggy night. If you need anything, just holler."
Vern didn't say anything. She just kept poring over her tablet computer and peering into the dark behind the bulkhead. He stood up unsteadily and walked away with careful steps. Just as he ducked through a hatch, he could have sworn he heard her say, "Thank you." He stopped and turned around. The 11 paces back to her hunched-over form seemed a long way for Mike. He needed to know something, and now was the time to ask it.
"Dr. Lee, a minute with you?" said Mike.
"Now?" asked Vern.
"Yes, please," said Mike.
"Well?" said Vern.
"What I have to say, or ask, really, isn't easy, but it's something I've been meaning to bring up for a little bit now," said Mike.
She stood up and pushed her viz glasses up onto her forehead, brushing a bead of sweat off the tip of her nose.
"This is hard to say, so I'll just outright say it," said Mike. "The railgun power system, something's wrong with it, am I right? That's why you're pushing both the crew and the geeks so hard. You know something they don't."
He expected her to dismiss him. Instead, she smiled. "You're right. It's not going to pass the test," said Vern.
"Shit," said Mike. "This is going to kill the captain."
"And maybe all of us," said Vern. "We'll have to see."
"I need to tell him," said Mike.
"You care for him," said Vern.
"If the ship can't fight, well, he can't," said Mike.
"He's your son. Why wouldn't you want it all to work out for him?" said Vern.
"I'll get going then, Dr. Lee," said Mike.
"There's something else you forgot to ask me, isn't there?" said Vern.
What would that be, Dr. Lee?" said Mike.
"The big question," said Vern, "the most important one." Mike looked at her quizzically. "Will it ever work?" said Vern.
He smiled. "Well, I guess that will depend on you."
"Give it time," said Vern. "An old guy like you should know how to be patient."
Fort Mason, San Francisco. Jamie Simmons slipped into bed, but he was too wired to fall right asleep. He thought of all the cobbled-together Ghost Fleet ships in the bay. His own ship, the one that the country needed most, was turning out to be the weak link. He lay back, studying the fog bank, now at the deck level of the Golden Gate Bridge. Its rise was almost imperceptible until it obscured something big from view. There was nothing you could do to drive it away. It didn't have the tide's regularity, and for that reason, it was all the more spectacular when it robbed you of the sight of something you took for granted, like the bridge. A loud gurgle of the pipes woke Lindsay, who groggily turned over.
"You're here. I didn't hear you come in," she said.
"Yeah," he whispered. "I didn't want to wake you." "What's all that with the pipes?" he asked.
"Toilet," she said, starting to wake up, broken again.
"Damn it," he said. "I'll take a look in the morning."
"When?" "You're always out so early," she said.
"Then when I get home," he said.
"And when will that be, Jamie? You can get a warship fixed up, but the toilet is too much to handle?" she said. "I'm sure that makes sense to somebody, just not me anymore."
There was an old Navy saying that ships were like mistresses, beautiful, alluring, mysterious, requiring lots of attention, and ultimately, marriage killers.
"I'll look at it right now," he said.
The edge in his voice caused her to prop herself up on one elbow and study him.
"You can say it, Jamie," she said. "Whatever you want, just say it."
He kissed her on the forehead, not trusting anything that might come out of his mouth. His heavy footsteps said enough. The same frustration he felt at work was now part of his home. After a half hour of struggling in vain with the toilet, he gave up and went back to the bedroom to find the kids asleep in bed with Lindsay. He must have woken them with all the rummaging around with the tools his father had left wedged behind the sink. He sat down in the old leather recliner in the corner of the room and watched them in the near darkness, trying to let the sounds of the trio's breathing drain away his stress and frustration. What he wanted to fix most, he feared he could not. When he woke, it was just past 5 in the morning. Shit, he had overslept by an hour.
Did you fix the potty, Daddy?
Said Martin groggily from the bed. No, sweetie, it's still broken, he said.
Call Grandpa, he can fix it, said Claire.
You should call him, said Lindsay, eyeing him warily. He shook his head as the room's sensors picked up their movement and began to gradually brighten the overhead lights.
I said I'm gonna fix it and I will.
We want Grandpa,
Claire and Martin shouted.
It's not time to get up yet, kids, said Lindsay, shooing them out of the bed. Back to your rooms.
We're not calling him,
said Jamie in a whisper as she walked past, leading the kids down the hall. He went to the bathroom and showered. Under the unrelenting spray of the cold water, he cursed himself. There were too few days before he went out to sea for them to have a night like this. He turned off the shower and shivered. Was this how Dad felt when he helplessly watched his connection with his family fray? Or had he just been unwilling to try to fix it? That was the difference. His dad hadn't wanted to try. It had to be the difference. Jamie was not willing to give up. I'm a better man than my dad, Jamie told himself as he blinked away the fatigue and cold water, even on my worst days. Honolulu, Hawaii Special Administrative Zone. Carrie wiped her hands on the front of the old black Hurley pullover that she'd worn to the beach. Then she took her backpack into the bathroom and shut the door. She pulled her still wet bathing suit bottom out of the bag, tossed it into the shower, and rinsed out the sand in the hot water. Then, as the bathroom filled with steam, she undressed, looking at herself in the fogged mirror. The naked body she saw, its beauty obscured by the moisture on the glass, could have been anybody's. She was anonymous. After she got out of the shower, she pulled a small makeup compact from the backpack. She tapped it twice on the counter, and the cover popped up. She licked her index finger on her right hand and rubbed it around the rim of the compact. There. She held up her hand to the light and saw the hair. She pulled her fiancé's black plastic brush from the jewelry box on the counter. She blew gently on her finger, and the hair fell onto the brush. Carefully, she put the brush back in the box. Carrie sat down on the toilet and closed her eyes. Now she saw them again. Then she saw her fiancé, and finally she saw her father. The inch-long cuts she made on her left thigh wiped the images of the men away. Eyes still shut, she didn't see the blood dripping onto the blue tile at her feet. The clatter of the scissors on the floor jarred her back from the moment. She stifled a cry of pain and began to wipe the blood away with her palms. She moved to the sink for a towel and then stopped. The fog on the mirror receded just enough for Carrie to look herself in the eyes. I am not anonymous, she told herself. I am death. Walmart Printing Facility, Ogden, Utah. In many ways, it was like watching an old Xerox copy machine in action. A thin layer of graphene chips was sprayed down by a roller that moved from one side of the table to the other. Essentially, carbon atoms laid out in the same hexagonal structure of chicken wire. Graphene was light and strong, and it was a great conductor. But more important, it was made from the same carbon atoms that formed everything from graphite to charcoal, so it could be sourced easily. Indeed, the graphene in this run of the machine had been pulled from the smoke of a coal-fired power plant. There was a burning smell as a laser fired, igniting a tiny flame where the light beam came into contact with the graphene dust, melting and fusing the particles together. Then the roller swept back in the other direction, laying down another thin layer, the laser firing again, back and forth, back and forth. In each microscopic layer, the laser carved out new shapes in the powder.
Slowly, a form began to rise, akin to pieces of paper stacking up. As the laser fused it all together, the form grew into an intricate latticework, almost like a honeycomb. The roller paused as a robotic hand reached over, turned the object 30 degrees, and inserted a feed of electrical wire, and then the layering began again. In 10 minutes, the form was complete. The robotic hand reached back in and lifted it up, and a spray of air blew off the remaining dust that clung to the object. The arm then moved the object outside the machine and put it in a cardboard box. After 60 forms had been placed in the box, an alarm rang. A human worker scurried over, quickly closed the box, and ran a line of packing tape over it, sealing it shut. He slapped a barcode sticker on it, and another worker loaded the box onto a robotic pallet mover that drove itself down the aisles. Where once garden gnomes and children's bicycles had been stacked and stored, ready for distribution across the retail network, there now stood boxes of reverse-engineered spare parts, from machine gun belts to wheel brackets to, in this case, a power coupling needed at Mare Island. Outside the warehouse, an 18-wheeler truck waited with a manifest for the various items that would be distributed and delivered by the next day. Back inside, the direct digital manufacturing machine, also known as a 3D printer, continued its work. A new software package had been downloaded, and now the device began to build an entirely different object. The process had the efficiency of an assembly line, but the flexibility to shift on demand and build any design that could be modeled with computer software. And even better, it could reproduce itself. The protocol, as voted on by Leanne's shareholders, dictated that every 10th run would produce parts for additional 3D printers. These would then be sold at a discount to the firms that had originally been in Walmart's supply chain. The seeds of both a manufacturing revolution and a new kind of defense industrial complex were being sown within the world's largest retail chain. Lotus Flower Club, former French concession, Shanghai. Ritual could be deadly, but ritual also offered its own protection. If you followed the same patterns day after day after day, those watching knew that you had nothing to hide. So Russian Air Force Major General Sergei Sechin had been going to the Lotus Flower Club now for 3 years. The same girl. He never asked her name. He knew her only by her number, 23. 23 wore her jet black hair short, cropped in a spiky mess that looked sultry, not sloppy. She might have been from Tibet, he wasn't sure. He never asked. Never bothered her with fake conversation. Maybe that was why her dark eyes seemed to light up just a slight bit whenever she saw Sechin, which was once every 2 weeks. That was enough. He was no longer a young man. She was chipped, of course. His Chinese counterparts could have all the biofeedback they wanted of an old man's best effort at screwing his way toward a fleeting moment of escape from age and decay. But at the Lotus Flower Club, that also meant she was wired into the room's screens on all four walls and the ceiling. The screens pulsed colors depending on her level of arousal. Whatever pills she took worked, because the explosions of light that finished off each session were unlike anything Sechin had ever seen. It was like an aurora borealis in the bedroom. The concierge guided Sechin to his usual room and left him. Sechin knocked once, then entered. But she was not the usual 23. The girl under the purple sheets had blue hair and sharp Nordic features. Shit. Moscow must have sent her. If this was an attempt to kill him, it was not the way he'd thought it would happen. He turned to leave. Let them shoot me in the back, the cowards. Da ich mejif, she said. He froze. Klingon. She had just spoken Klingon. What did you say? He asked. Da ich mejif, she repeated. Now he was intrigued. This was too artful for the directorate or his own intelligence service. Who leaves a beautiful woman, indeed? He sat on the bed and placed one hand on her leg. So, we have a language in common. What shall we talk about? He replied in Klingon. Come here, she said. I'm cold. I need you to warm me. If you're not careful, such clumsy talk may make an old man lose his will, he said. Perhaps I can help. Then she lowered the sheet, revealing her breasts.
I can make them bigger if you like, she said, or smaller, whatever you wish.
She put a device the size of a matchbox on the nightstand. Biomorphic breast augmentation was increasingly common and inexpensive in China. In Russia, it was taboo and therefore a rarity. Whoever had performed the surgery was very talented.
There's no need, said Sechen under his breath. They're perfect as they are, really.
He undressed quickly, leaving his clothes in a pile at the foot of the bed.
Your socks, she said with a giggle.
What about them? He said as he climbed in.
You can take them off, she said.
Never, so I can make a quick getaway, he said with a wink.
Not too quick, please, she said.
She pulled the sheets over them. Then she pulled another blanket made of thin metallic fabric over the sheets. She put a hand over his mouth, and her eyes turned cold and serious. And Sechen realized he was probably not going to get laid, nor was he going to die. The good with the bad. Such is the intelligence business, he thought. She stuck her hand out from under the bed's blanket, and he heard a faint click. What he heard next stunned him. The sounds of Sechen and the previous 23 making love echoed through the room.
Do I really sound like that, like a boar with a spear stuck in its side? He thought.
Our mutual friend from the Federation sends his best, she whispered in his ear.
So the American had heard him after all.
Then tell me this. Why did he not listen to me when it mattered? Said Sechen. I risked everything just by using the word Cherenkov. He could have done something.
He is doing something now and you can too, she said.
Wait, are you chipped? He asked.
Yes, but not by lotus flower. I'm still a new girl, she said. They're going to wait to see if I work out before they invest in me. Now tell me about Cherenkov
and none of the Star Trek shit. The air under the blanket was heating up quickly, and Sechen felt his face flushing from the warmth and his proximity to her. He watched a rivulet of sweat carve an arc between her breasts and move toward an enormous tattoo, wreathing her waist.
It was developed about 3 years ago at the Russian Foundation for Advanced Research Projects outside Moscow. Our equivalent to your DARPA, he said. It's nuclear reactor detection from space.
How does it work? She asked.
There is not enough time now. I will get you something to take them next time, he said. I support your superiors who will also need to know why I am doing this.
Why you're in bed with me, you mean? She said.
They would understand that, I hope. Americans are not prudish, he said.
Okay, then why? She asked.
Our dear leader so badly wants to matter in his old age that he fails to see that one day this will all go bad for Russia. America and Russia had our row in the last century, and it is done. I've been here long enough to know that the Directorate is the real threat, and this war only makes them stronger. Russia is merely the junior partner, and it just happens to have 15 million Chinese residing inside its borders. It does not take an old spy to see that one day, very soon, the Chinese will assert their right to protect their compatriots in Siberia, just as we once did to the weak states on our borders. And that is why I tried to warn your officer, for all the good it did.
It's usually more personal. What do you want from this? She said.
Sechen sighed and ran a finger between her breasts.
My dear, he said, don't we all want the same thing? Money, sex, a bit of power? Any of the three are fine with me. I'm not particular anymore.
She rolled her eyes. At that moment, the recording of one of his sessions with 23 ended with an animal abruptness. She reached out to start the recording over.
Don't worry, it's been modified, so it'll sound like we're beginning again, she whispered in his ear.
Then she pulled back and looked him in the eye as the grunts started once more.
I don't believe you. We've seen your profile. You're too much of a romantic for the usual banal causes.
Too much of a romantic, says the whore I am in bed with.
Okay, have it your way, she said.
Her voice went from a purr to command mode. Put your hand here. She took his hand and placed it at her waist, stopping at the tattoo.
Do you know what that is?
He didn't feel a thing, but he knew enough to make a guess.
It's one of the new e-tattoos.
She looked surprised for a second.
I'm not as old as you might think, he said.
The ink of the tattoo was actually a derivative of the electronic ink used in the old tablet computer readers. This modified version allowed the liquid injected into the skin to act as a sort of pillow above and below tiny embedded silicon chips wired together in an origami-like pattern. The liquid and microscopic serpentine wires formed a miniature network woven into her skin. He closed his eyes and traced its outlines while he hummed the middle section of Dmitri Shostakovich's Fifth Symphony.
"I'm going to need you to do something for me, and I can't lie. It's going to hurt," she finally said. "But we think it's the best way to securely get us the information you offer."
"I was afraid you might ask that," he said.
She kissed him gently on the chin.
"How can you know pleasure without understanding pain?"
she responded as she kissed him again. North Fork of the Kakanahua Stream, Oahu, Hawaii Special Administrative Zone.
"Push the pace,"
Conan hissed, walking in the knee-deep river water.
"Or we're going to miss our window to get inside the perimeter."
Finn didn't reply. The only noise was his sandals' soft sucking in the mud. The stream was low, hedged in on either side by thick emerald vegetation and slashes of brown. The two walked with hunched backs, their wool blankets drooping heavily on aching shoulders. They were the tail end of the patrol. Four more Muj strung out ahead. Charlie had point. He wasn't military like the rest, but it was time to break him in. He'd been a golf pro at the Turtle Bay Resort, once a star player for Wake Forest University, but never making it past the Nike Tour level. Finn had served with Charlie's older brother Aaron, the three of them going out drinking whenever Aaron visited on leave. The Muj had used Charlie's apartment as a hide site 2 months back, and he had demanded to go with them. Charlie had said that his big brother had kicked his ass bad enough when they were little, and he wouldn't survive what happened after the war if Aaron found out he hadn't been in the fight. The cuts and scrapes on their legs attested to the night's hike almost to the top of a nearby peak. They had pulled up 150 yards short of the summit to avoid highlighting their position along the ridgeline, and Conan had disappeared for an hour while the rest set a security detail below. Conan would not tell Finn or any of the others why they'd had to go there. They knew she kept it from them for operational security, but it still made the whole trek a sullen expedition. Now, after a long hike back down, it was raining. Finn splashed into the swollen stream behind Conan and trudged on through the water. Going that way, they left no tracks and erased their movement signature in case they were being monitored from above. But really, he'd have chosen to go the stream route anyway. He had an infected cut on his heel that felt better in the water. They arrived at a small pedestrian bridge they had hidden the bicycles under. It was a motley mix they'd picked up along the way, just like their array of weapons. Finn had scored the best, a 27.5-inch wheeled carbon downhill mountain bike with motorcycle-like suspension they'd stolen from a vacation villa whose owners were unlikely to come back until the war was over. Conan rode a 3-speed faded green beater with a narrow white racing seat that they'd found unlocked by the side of the road. Their guess was that it had been a drunk cycle, a bike used to pedal from bar to bar before it was pressed into wartime duty. They left in ones and twos, going out through Hidden Valley Estates to California Avenue. Movement in the open like this had to be carefully choreographed because of the directorate's tracking algorithms, which poured through aerial and satellite sensor footage. Over time, any unusual patterns would become distinct, and therefore targetable. The trick was to find patterns that were part of the standard ebb and flow, but also had slightly random components that could explain away any anomalies. Patterns like the daily rhythms of kids biking to and from their elementary school. As the flow of children heading into Iliahi Elementary School, a few on their own, others dropped off by their parents, started to slow, Conan nodded at Finn. Like on patrol, they staggered their arrivals. They'd go in with the latecomers and then swing toward the back, where there was an outbuilding used for storing athletic equipment. For the past 4 months, Coach Moaki, the gym teacher, had allowed the Muj to stash a few boxes of grenades, stims, and ammunition there. The insurgents also slept there from time to time. It was one of many caches they used in the area. They knew a few of the other teachers were likely aware of what they were doing, but not a single one ever made eye contact with them.
"You know, before this, I used to do triathlons," Finn said to Conan as they waited in the vegetation by the road. "Get up at 0500 for a trail run, and then go 20 miles on the bike. Oh, and camping, for fun. That's pretty much what we're doing now, right? Well, screw that. When this is all over, I'm going to move to New York City and never go outside again."
They had just mounted their bikes when a shot rang out.
"Pistol," said Conan, "at the school."
Moana Surf Rider Hotel, Waikiki Beach, Hawaii Special Administrative Zone. He had been to the old hotel many times before, never to sleep. The place felt too much like a target for a truck bomb. He came every so often just to swim and drink fresh pineapple and guava juice. The beach was perfection, perhaps worth the invasion for just this stretch, Markov thought. If they had let him, he would have slept on the beach. He would have preferred it to the cheap motel by the airport that the Chinese had turned into barracks. At the moment, he was in the wrong company for a day on the sand. Jian, as ever, dutifully followed behind. Markov wore his Russian army fatigues, which were getting more and more faded with each day in the Pacific sun. He would rather have worn local clothes, but the few times he had done that, it had only brought him grief with General Yu. The two men crossed the lobby, slowing their pace to take advantage of the air conditioning. As they weaved through groups of directorate sailors, soldiers, and Marines, Markov noticed that Jian had taken to walking 5 meters behind him. The bastard was trying to act like he was simply going in the same direction, embarrassed at his peers seeing him with the Russian. As they passed one of the bars, Markov almost stopped, stricken by a sudden thirst. Then he pushed past the temptation and moved on to the intended destination. "Hi, boys," said the woman behind the surf desk. "I'm sorry, but your teammates took them all. No boards left." He was struck by the banal tone of her voice. In his whole time in Hawaii, he had never heard a local speak without some fleck of anger. But this woman sounded as if she were talking to a sunburned family of four from Chicago. Either she was on quite a cocktail of drugs, or she was an utter idiot. "It's too bad, you know," she continued, "because today there's a perfect swell for beginners." Markov walked closer to the desk and locked eyes with her.
"Regrettably, this is work," he said. "We're looking for information about a directorate officer whose body was found on the beach."
"I heard," she said. "It's so sad."
The nameplate on the desk identified her as Carrie Shin. Markov walked his eyes down Carrie's body, passing over her breasts but looking closely at her arms, searching for signs of needle tracks that might explain her demeanor. Maybe a little makeup on her forearm, but he couldn't be sure without looking at the skin up close.
"It is sad. How did he get possession of one of the hotel's boards?" said Markov.
"We think he took it after hours. We didn't think we had to lock them up anymore," said Shin.
Her voice lowered and her shoulders sagged, as if even the possibility of theft saddened her.
"When did he last rent a board here?"
he asked. "I saw him once," she said, "maybe 2 weeks ago. I think that was his first time surfing. He was really excited. He asked about a lesson, but I couldn't do it then. I wish I had. Sandy Beach Park is one of the most dangerous places on the islands to surf. Not a good place for a beginner."
Markov studied the way her tan skin seemed to give back some of the sun's warmth. He leaned in closer for his next question, wondering just how dark the circles under her eyes were when the makeup was washed away.
"Are there any other employees whom I should talk to?" he said.
She smiled and leaned away, arching her back in a subtle stretch.
"This hotel is the safest place in town for everyone. That's the point, isn't it?" she said. "Why would anyone do anything to upset that?"
"Yes, certainly.
The one thing I never heard was how he died."
She chattered on, slaking her curiosity in a way other locals never would have dared.
"What did happen to him?"
"The board's leash got caught around his neck," said Markov. "But it is not yet clear whether it was an accident or not.
Oh my God, that's horrible, she said. Wasn't there any video of the beach? Maybe a wave cam?
Nothing, he said, nothing at all. He paused. But as part of the revised security measures, we will be collecting something better from all the staff here.
Better than pictures? She said.
Much better, DNA, he said. That way we can track our friends throughout the island, he said.
Friends like me? She said.
Exactly, he said.
Iliahi Elementary School, Wahiawa, Hawaii, Special Administrative Zone. The body lay sprawled face down on the ground. The mesh bag of soccer balls that the Chinese Marine had brought for the students to play with had opened, and the balls had spilled out. Bright pink and yellow spheres rolled around the courtyard, leaving trails of blood behind them. Nick's grip on her Sig Sauer P220 loosened for a moment. Then she squeezed the pistol tighter. Her hearing returned, and her field of vision widened, allowing her to take in the chaos. Parents and children screamed over the ringing in her ears. This was what the coach had been trying to warn them about when Nix and the other three insurgents turned left off California Avenue. The coach had smiled a welcome, but had waved his hands off to the side. Nix cursed herself for missing the cue, caught up momentarily in the flash of normalcy brought on by the giddy kids around them.
Contact! Shouted Charlie.
A bit late for that, said Nix. You hit?
No, I don't think so, said Charlie. There's gotta be more. Where are they?
A Chinese Marine burst around the gym corner, his assault rifle spraying wildly. A shot took Charlie in the neck. Nix, with her pistol already up, instinctively fired two .45 caliber rounds at a distance of 10 feet. The Marine spun and collapsed over a blue hippo sculpture in the school's courtyard. More fearful shouts in Chinese came from where the Marine had been. Nix and the two other insurgents rounded the corner and found a lone Chinese civilian, evidently a member of one of the new community development units they'd been sending around to split the population from the insurgents, crying into a radio. She had a pistol, but made no motion to use it. Her two escorts were now dead. They dragged her past Charlie's still body and over to the entrance of the building, and they took cover by the doors. After a moment, the woman stopped crying, and the unsettling calm that followed close combat came over Nix. Her ears rang, her hands tingled, and she felt like her feet were so firmly planted in the ground she couldn't take another step if her life depended on it. The feeling would pass, as it always did after the adrenaline waned, but in the moment, it took everything she had to stay focused and think about what was supposed to happen next.
She was on the radio, Nix shouted to her squad mates, too loud because her ears were still ringing. I don't know if she got someone on the other end, but we gotta tell Conan this place is blown and get clear.
She looked up and saw three kids peering down at her from behind the blue painted railings on the school's second floor balcony. They looked blankly at the dead bodies, and then at the NSM members. Then, one by one, they began to look skyward, until they were all squinting at the sky to the south. That was when Nix's ears cleared, and she heard it too, the thumping of helicopter rotors coming closer. Hidden Valley Estates, Wahiawa, Hawaii, Special Administrative Zone. Conan and Finn cut through the empty parking lot of the Mormon church adjacent to the school, jumping off their bikes as they entered a stand of trees separating the church from the houses nearby. They kept beneath the long canopy of thick green foliage that ran through the clusters of one-story and two-story homes in the Hidden Valley Estates housing complex. Seeing a quadcopter drone zoom down the road toward the school, they ducked down and hid among the trees.
Hold there, said Conan.
Screw that, let's go, said Finn. We can get to the cache, arm up, and then get them out.
Conan shook her head. No, we can't, she said.
Neighbors had begun to spill out of their homes into the street, pointing and screaming. Some of them, probably parents, were rushing toward the school, racing against the arrival of the directorate forces. Finn turned to look at her, trying to puzzle it out.
Conan, our guys are one thing, but the kids? There are kids there.
Exactly, said Conan quietly.
What? What do you think is going to happen? Said Finn.
She didn't answer, just stared back at him. Finn tried to get up, but she wrestled him down.
He had just shrugged off her grip when a pair of Directorate Z-8K assault helicopters roared overhead, and then spun to flare just above the playing field next to the school. One after another, black-suited Directorate commandos jumped out. They fanned out around the landing point, the equipment shed with the weapons cache now inside their perimeter. Finn ducked back under the brush and looked at her angrily.
Conan, you said our guys, they are going to fight, and those kids and teachers are going to be stuck in the middle of a shitstorm.
It was always a risk that something bad would go down at the school,
said Conan in a whisper.
Why do you think I chose it?
Fort Mason, San Francisco.
I love you.
Jamie knew what Lindsay would say when he walked through the door. She said it every night, even when he knew it was a struggle for her to get the words out. Nights like tonight when he returned home late, exhausted and drained. The adrenaline had ebbed months ago. What propelled him now was a cocktail of caffeine, stims, and anger. The boat hit the dock's edge gently, perfectly done, and he sharply saluted the shipyard launch that dropped him off at Pier 2 in the dark. It was a perk of command that spared him the long autobus ride home and kept him on the water that much longer. Plus, it was only a quick walk up to the house in Fort Mason, and he could be home in a few minutes once he set foot on land. Like every night, though, he first stopped and sat down on a bench, a vestige of a time when this was an area for festivals and tourists. From his seat, he looked west through the Golden Gate Bridge. The bridge was illuminated tonight, the LEDs woven into the cable wires, showing a winking flag displayed, 50 stars bright. It was something the governor had decided to do against the advice of the Defense Department. The bridge was a symbol of what they were fighting for, he argued, and should not be lost in the fog of war and the bay. That speech had gone over well, no doubt. One of his public affairs team's own social engineering algorithms had come up with it. Jamie took a last sip of coffee and slowly dumped the rest out, watching it spatter the ground at his feet. It was oddly soothing and had become a ritual as he tried to slow his mind down from the past 16 hours at work.
Halt! Said a voice in the dark.
Simmons looked up and saw no one. He was tired, but tired enough to hear things?
Identification, said a sentry.
It was one of the California National Guard troops who patrolled the waterfront around the clock.
Proceed, said Simmons. Captain James Simmons, Navy. I live at the fort. House 49.
The sentry scanned the barcode next to the left epaulette on Simmons's uniform.
Thank you, sir, said the sentry. Quiet night. No trouble, said Simmons.
No, there never is, said the sentry, suddenly sounding old and tired.
What's that smell?
He clutched his M4 closer to his chest and inhaled deeply.
Damn, is that real coffee?
Yes, from on board, said Simmons.
I knew I signed up for the wrong service.
When you work as a barista at Starbucks, and then the country runs out of coffee, well, you just can't drink the fake stuff on principle, said the sentry. That's when I joined up. Spent the first few weeks of basic with the worst headaches, though. I'd charge the beach myself if they could promise me a fresh cup of Kona Reserve on the other side.
We'll get you that Hawaiian coffee soon enough, said Simmons. Thank you, sir. You have a good night, said the sentry.
You too, said Simmons, and he started up the hill for home.
Jamie opened the front door quietly and slipped inside. At 11 o'clock, he'd missed the kids and dinner, but he could still spend an hour with Lindsay. Squeaking floorboards announced his arrival. The dining room was empty. He looked in the living room to see if she had fallen asleep on the couch reading.
Hey, Linz, still up?
He whispered. He looked around the floor of the living room. Where were the toys? Oddly, there was nothing underfoot. He remembered the frenetic cleanups his father had imposed on him when he was the same age as his kids now. The sight of toys out of place, any sign, really, that children lived in his house, would set his father off.
Linz?
He called again. He gingerly walked upstairs. A faint glow emanated from their bedroom. When he walked in, his heart soared and his stomach ached. Lindsay stood before him holding out a glass of sparkling wine, wearing only a red silk robe. Candles from their disaster kit lit the room.
from a big pink beach bucket filled with ice, the neck of a champagne bottle stood at attention.
"Happy anniversary," she said.
He took the flute and kissed her. How could he have forgotten?
15 years, he said.
"I found you, lost you, and got you back again," she said.
"Happy anniversary," he said. "Sorry I'm late for it."
"The kids are asleep, and the house is ours. For the next little while."
"I have to be in early tomorrow," he said.
"I know," she said. "You're going to be tired."
"Very," he said, removing the robe.
They made love with the patient pleasure that comes from focusing on each other completely. Afterward, they lay back and looked out at the bridge in the dark, fog beginning to devour its pillars.
"One day you're going back out there," she said.
"I know, and I know what I promised before all this. But I have to be out there now. You know that, right?"
"I'm not going to tell you not to go," she said. "But all I think about is that we haven't had enough time together. 15 years is not enough."
"No, it's not," he said. "What I do each day, I do to make sure I will be back. That's it in its simplest sense."
"I know," she said.
"My dad left my mom after 15 years, did you know that?" he said.
"Is that why you forgot tonight?" she said.
This wasn't one of those binary choices. He could go in so many different directions: anger, denial, submission, regret.
"I am so sorry, Lindsay," he said, "for tonight, for everything. For staying in the Navy when I told you I was done. I'm sorry. It's all I can say."
"Just don't do it again," she said,
and kissed him deeply. Hangar 1, Moffett Field, Mountain View, California. The thing that always jarred Daniel Oboye was the smell. The space was cavernous. 1,140 feet by 308 feet, to be exact, the size of 3 superdomes. But the smell filled even that void. To someone from outside the valley, it was the tangy funk of old pizza and people who'd gone too long without a shower. But to anyone local, it smelt like money, fame, power, success. So much had changed in Silicon Valley's startup scene during the past few decades, but there was one constant: this smell. And the fact that it now filled Hangar 1 made it all the more appropriate. In 1931, the city fathers of Sunnyvale, California, had come up with a unique plan for economic development. They'd raised $480,000 to buy nearly 1,000 acres of farmland, and then sold off the land to the U.S. government for $1. What was to make it such a good investment was the topography of the farmland. It was the only part of San Francisco Bay not regularly shrouded in fog. The deal was that Sunnyvale would then become the home for a newly planned Navy fleet of flying aircraft carriers, massive helium-filled airships that would serve as bases in the air for propeller biplanes. The plan didn't work out as anticipated, not for Sunnyvale or the blimps. In 1933, the USS Akron, the Navy's test airborne aircraft carrier, crashed. The plan was shelved, its only legacy that the airfield was renamed after Admiral William Moffett, the head of the Navy's Aeronautics Bureau, who had been killed in the crash. But fortunately for the town, World War II interceded a few years later, and Moffett Field became a base for patrol airplanes, and then the home of the U.S. Air Force Satellite Test Center. By the 1950s, several big aerospace firms clustered around the base and the test center. Thousands of scientists and engineers who moved into the Sunny Valley built close ties with local universities, and the old farmland became the hub of a different industry. The city fathers' plan of economic growth through blimp basing instead spawned what became known as Silicon Valley. In the defense drawdown of the 1990s, most of Moffett was abandoned, and the facility was handed over to NASA's Ames Research Center. Little remained of the military presence, except for its signature building, the largest hangar in the world. Bits and pieces of the base were sold off to private industry over the ensuing years, starting when Google acquired Hangar 1 and turned it into a site for executive jets. When he had first arrived in Silicon Valley and seen all that ambition and vision, let alone cash flow, Oboye felt outgunned. Now, he just had to make a phone call
and the massive hangar was at his disposal. Larry and Sergei had not asked what would happen inside. They knew only that he needed a massive space away from prying eyes. Now Hangar 1 was the team's new home, though they had taken to calling it Aboye's Ark. Taj Lamott, chief technology officer of UNI, had come up with that, a joke about either the size of the place or the crazy vision of the man who'd brought them all together. Daniel had been an early investor in UNI, which was now one of the leading video game studios in Palo Alto, and in a few of the firms he had quietly reached out to. At other firms, though, he wasn't an investor. His reputation had been enough. That and the simple lure of the offer. It was the opportunity, he had said, to be part of Silicon Valley's most important startup ever. The rule for selection had been simple. The CTO of each firm Aboye talked to would designate his or her three best programmers. The limited numbers were ostensibly to keep the project in stealth mode, as the investors called it. The goal was to hide their business not only from directorate spies, but also from the National Security Agency. Even if the NSA's networks weren't pawned by the directorate, which most people suspected they still were, anger over the sneak back doors of the old Snowden-era scandals lingered. The NSA had cost Silicon Valley hundreds of billions of dollars, and its citizens weren't in a forgiving mood, even years later. But the limited numbers were also about the value of an idea, its yield as well as its transformative power. Aboye and his group couldn't throw hundreds of thousands of programmers at the problem, as the directorate had done before the war with its so-called human flesh search machine censorship that had morphed into the massive hacker attack that opened the assault. Nor did they want to. They all knew that a great programmer was literally orders of magnitude better than a good one, and they also all knew from experience that the best way to accomplish something considered undoable was merely to bring the right minds together. Some of the CTOs had sent their top executives, including a few billionaire founders who relished the chance to get their hands dirty again. Others sent the smelly, misanthropic coding beasts they usually hid away in the basement. The sum total, though, made Hangar 1 the greatest gathering of geniuses since the Manhattan Project. The only other contribution each firm was asked to make was a single corporate jet. That was a key part of the cover. The volunteers would show up at Hangar 1 as if they were heading out of town, and then the jets would fly off to various business conferences and corporate off-site meetings. However, each jet would fly out just a few people short. It had been a perfect cover story, until the matter of pizza had come up. Daniel had solved that by creating another startup company located in an office complex just across the street. Although the business was supposedly an app maker for the healthcare industry, its sole purpose was to serve as a destination for the pizza deliveries. It had all worked so far. As Aboye waited for the test, he pinched the skin at the inside of his wrist, just as he had done as a boy when the hunger got so bad he would see double. How long had it been since he'd had to worry about his next meal? 30 years? 40? Now the familiar pain soothed his anxiety. He had a lot to worry about at this moment. The bank of monitors along the wall in the southwest corner of the control room flashed and winked with a rainbow array of colors, each a hue hinting at failure. "Here it goes," he said to the engineers assembled in a circle at the center of the room. Together they stood, staring hard into the shifting light form in the middle of their grouping, moving their gloved hands in syncopated rhythms. They had depicted the directorate data networks as a library. There were three levels to the holographic building, and a white-painted atrium let in an amber sunset that illuminated the central hall. The hologram rendered six of Aboye's team in the middle of the atrium, each as a featureless black form that looked to be made of turbid smoke. The wraith-like bodies had no identifying features. Aboye watched Taj maestroing his part, his fingers in the gloves dancing away like a conductor's as he stood uneasily on a swiveling chair mounted on casters. It was something that he swore helped him focus, even if the risk of falling and failure was higher now than it ever had been. A few billion richer, he was still the same Taj that Aboye had met 9 years ago during a job interview, at which Aboye had told Taj he was so talented that he could not in good conscience hire him. They had been friends ever since, and Aboye now wondered if this was what he had actually wanted Taj to do all along.
This is the jumping-off point, said Aaron Smythe, nominated by the group to be the program's chief engineer, largely because of her comparatively calm demeanor. Outside the hangar, she worked on network design for Amazon. She was a tall, thin woman who moved with precise, choppy gestures whether or not she was working in a sim. Like the rest of the engineers and programmers, she wore the same kind of form-fitting one-piece gray utility coveralls used by astronauts. That had been the Tesla team's idea. At first, it seemed to Oboye like they were playing dress-up. But over time, he saw how they stood taller when they put on the suits.
Wyke, you're first.
Smythe's voice almost bubbled with excitement. Oboye knew why she and the rest of them were happy. They were re-experiencing the joy of a startup, discovering what their unbound minds could accomplish. In the holographic projection, one of the dark forms dashed from the library atrium into the shadows of the stacks. Then another.
Taj, next, said Smythe.
The casters on Taj's chair began to creak, and he twisted slightly back and forth as he manipulated the control rings on his fingers. What he saw on his goggles was only for him, but the jerky gestures attested to a problem. On the holographic screen, the black forms ran in and out of the atrium, dropping off books in what was now a burning pyre in the middle of the room.
Fudge! Shouted Taj, still the innocent little boy at heart. Gosh darn motherfudging network!
The library's glass ceiling crashed in, and water began to come through, the simulated network's automated defense now reacting. First came a heavy rain, which the wraiths tried to shoot fire back at. The visualization of their counter-programs. But then came a vast, unending deluge, as if a river had been diverted and was pouring into the atrium. Taj's chair toppled over, and he tried to catch himself, but landed hard on his tailbone. He rolled over onto his side, clutching his wrist. The hologram's library pyre was now extinguished, and the black forms found themselves underwater. They flickered out one by one as the water rose quickly from floor to floor. Smythe turned off the hologram and looked at Oboye with something like shame. The automated defenses had detected and defeated them. The cone of light around them brightened slightly, indicating the test was over. Oboye moved to help Taj up, but then checked himself. Angrily, he thought that perhaps Taj needed to learn a lesson from the pain, and maybe grow up a bit. He turned his back on the group and made for the darkness across the hangar, walking past row after row of murmuring servers, the waves of warmth washing over him. He reached the exit. He faintly heard Smythe issuing commands to the room, but the rushing of blood in his ears prevented him from understanding them. As soon as he was outside, he sat down, closed his eyes, and covered his head with his arms. He sighed. What else could he do? This was not working out like it was supposed to. He felt a hand on his shoulder. He sprang up and saw Taj, a white cryo pack on his wrist.
Is it all right? Asked Oboye.
My wrist or the project? Said Taj. Thanks for making sure I was okay.
My apologies, I didn't handle that well, said Oboye. You know how I can be, and well, this didn't go as planned.
Look, there's no sugarcoating it, we're in trouble. Running out of time and money too, said Taj.
I will spend every last dollar I have, Oboye said. I started with nothing, so that is not my fear. I fear failure, and what it would mean for this country. We need to succeed because of the importance of our mission, yes, that is crucial. But there is something bigger on the line. Do you know what it is?
I've been going full tilt for 3 days. Stop with the riddles, said Taj.
We need to become again the country that breaks the hard problems, that sees the virtue in innovation and the reward in risk, he said. If we do not succeed, then I worry that all truly is lost.
Daniel, stop trying to put the weight of the world on your shoulders. We'll never crack it if we think that way. We all join for that stuff, but also for the challenge. That's the fun part.
Oboye could muster no reply. Instead, he turned from Taj and walked slowly down the runway, gazing up at the starry sky.
As he walked along the deserted tarmac, the massive hangar building slowly shrank behind him, and clouds gradually hid the stars above him. A gust of wet wind left a fine mist on his face, and he stopped in the middle of the runway. He felt truly lost, and he did the only thing he knew to do when he felt that way. He sank to his knees and began to pray.
USS Zumwalt, Mare Island Naval Shipyard.
Smells like victory, somebody said. Laughter followed.
Vern Lee peeked out between the fist-sized gap in the curtain on her bunk. Flashes of flesh, gray underwear. She wrinkled her nose as the stink of digested rations worked its way into her bunk. It mixed with the smell of her coveralls, her sweat, and the remnants of epoxy from some of the structural reinforcements she'd been trying to work around a few hours before. She smiled and stifled a laugh. It was so awful, all of it, that you just had to give in to it. It had been 3 days since she'd showered. Closing her eyes, she tried to wedge herself into the corner. But what had started out as laughter flipped over to tears as quickly as powering on a pair of glasses. She felt silly, knowing the mix of laughter and tears was just from being so tired and loopy. Before the war, she had planned to redefine how to power machines. Energy, the magic of the battery, was the essence of their utility. It was what gave machines life and gave humans their life force, an electrical spirit. Or so she'd thought when she was smoking weed in high school. Now, she was just a machine herself, no different than any other device on the ship. She felt drained, empty. Vern wiped her tears away and slipped on her glasses to check the time. 0443. She batted the curtain aside, trying to ignore the yellow pulsing 14.3 in the corner of her vision that indicated the number of hours of REM sleep she needed in order to return to average performance. She hoped the rainbow glow of the code she reviewed as she made her way to the galley would help obscure her red eyes. Somehow she would get through another day. Out in the hallway, or passageway, as the crew kept correcting her, she followed the line headed toward the galley.
"Good morning, Dr. Lee," said a voice behind her.
Mike stood in the middle of the passageway, a massive ceramic coffee cup held loosely in his left hand. He wore his usual orange utility vest over the navy blue overalls, a color combination that made him look like one of those prisoners from the Syrian intervention. But the old guy still had that something, she had to admit. He'd aged well, sort of like that old movie star the People Zine kept putting in their annual list, decades after his first time on the cover.
"Can I ask you to come with me to the Railgun magazine? Need you to take a look at something I'm working on," he said.
She looked at him blankly, still trying to wake up fully.
"If you want, you can grab some chow. The work can hold for a few minutes," he said.
"Maybe for you, old man, but all a modern girl needs is a little willpower and a lot of pill power." She stepped into the galley and grabbed a bright red can of Coke Prime and an inch-long foil packet of energy and sustenance pills. Vern's stomach was growling, but she didn't want to show weakness. She smiled to herself. It was all the same. Whether you were on the high school volleyball team, in grad school, or at war, never let him see you sweat.
"All right, then," he said with a slight tone of admiration. "Breakfast of champions it is, Dr. Lee."
But as Vern followed Mike down the passageway, she held the cold metal of the can to her forehead, trying to keep back the headache until the pills hit. They came to a hatch, what the Navy guys called a door, and Mike moved aside to let her pass through first. She thought he'd smell like old man or engine grease, but instead she smelled citrus.
"Don't want you getting scurvy. We had to worry about that back in my day," he said, as he held out a freshly peeled orange to her.
She took the orange with a smile. The railgun magazine extended below the turret, deeper into the ship, and that was where Vern sat, on an upturned plastic crate. She watched Mike, welding, and slowly ate the orange slices, savoring the tartness. This space was cramped, and she sat within arm's reach of Mike. Looking through her goggles, she saw the flare of the welding torch create an eclipse-like profile of the old chief. Streaks of sweat tracked down his neck. Then the torch abruptly snapped off. He lifted his welding mask, eyes blinking at the smoke, and moved so that she could see the rack that held the armatures for the railgun rounds.
"You see how it's done, Dr. Lee?" said Mike.
She slowly chewed her last orange slice, unsure what he meant.
"The welds. I want you to see how it's done," he said. "Up there in the turret. We can do it your way. but you're missing the technique, the art of it. If you just melt the surface of the wire or fitting and let it stick to the surface, it might be good enough for some lab, but it wouldn't hold under the kind of pressures we could get in action. It's about doing it smoothly to ensure a proper mixing of the materials. Let me show you. Put my mask on. Pass me your goggles. He motioned her over to the square of blue foam padding he'd been kneeling on and handed her a pair of welding gloves. Those gloves should fit. I had to guess the size, but I think I got it. So, this is structural, what we're doing. Nobody's going to see it, but everybody's going to depend on it, he said. We'll do a first pass, then we'll see how it goes.
She knelt, and he sat on the box behind her, reaching around to her left side to help her keep a steady hand as the torch flared. Back and forth they went until Mike let her use the torch without his help.
There you go. Make a puddle. Keep track of that as it builds, he said,
guiding her hand slowly across the seam where the armature rack connected to the deck.
We'll need to make a few passes, and then let it cool, then again. Good technique comes with practice.
Why aren't you using a laser welder? Asked Vern.
Because there's no reason to get fancy, said Mike. The old MIG welder works, so why change? No need to teach an old dog new tricks if the old ones still get the job done. You'll learn that one eventually.
Lotus Flower Club, former French concession, Shanghai. He knew not to ask her name, so for now, she was just the new 23. Sechen opened the door and found her waiting under the sheets. Her eyes were wide open, unblinking, and tracked him with the kind of focus that came from a pill. To Sechen, she looked harder and, while still beautiful, slightly less inviting. The downsides of a professional's existence. Once again, purpose trod upon pleasure, thought Sechen. With the old 23, everything was about what he wanted. With the new 23, it was about what she wanted. First details on the Cherenkov program, and now information on directorate defenses in the Northern Pacific. Once he'd undressed and folded his clothes, he slipped under the sheets. They were orange this time. The delight of being under the covers with her warm, naked body was undeniable. It was that moment he savored. That first moment of contact with her skin as she quickly pulled the sheets over him. She put a finger to her lips, and he nodded. She lay back and closed her eyes. He watched her chest rise and fall with her steady breathing. He studied the tattoo at her waist. It was an intricate wreath of roses and snakes. He made out a cobra and a coral snake. There were two others that he couldn't identify. The roses were beautiful. Then she turned on the recording of Sechen and the previous 23's lovemaking and began to arrange the thin blanket that would shield their conversation. He felt his cheeks flush with embarrassment.
I think it is everything you are looking for, said Sechen, but I can't guarantee that I was able to get it out clean. I tried, but there is an urgency to all of this that—
Are you compromised? She demanded, leaning on one elbow. She ran a finger down his chest and stopped at a fresh scar just below his navel. It was about an inch wide and was covered with the clear surgical glue used to seal the incision. Sechen had made the cut himself, using the surgery pin he found in the CIA dead drop behind an eel vendor's stall at Shanghai's Tangjiangwanlu wet market.
Entirely,
he said with a dramatic sigh that released a warm cloud of stale tobacco and vodka under the covers. 23 wrinkled her nose with disappointment.
This is not the time to make jokes, she said. So tell me, are you compromised?
I'm fine, he said. Like I said, I moved quickly because I had to. But I was careful, I always am.
Then let's proceed, she said, and you can relax.
Happily, he said. Do you want to be on top?
She shook her head and shifted her weight under him. Her hand probed around the area of his incision. He winced at the pain, and she apologized.
Okay, I feel the chip, she said. Move a little to the left, your left, there.
The epidermal electronic reader hidden in the tattoo's ink vibrated faintly as it downloaded Sechen's file with a tickling sensation. He tried to kiss her and she pulled back.
Stop, she hissed. Hold very, very still.
The vibration continued for almost a minute and then both of them looked at each other as the sensation abruptly ceased.
That wasn't so bad, he said. Is it enough to end the war? Certainly wars have been started for less.
I need to go, she said, trying to roll him off her. This cannot wait.
Of course it can, he said. Besides, if I leave too quickly, won't they think you're not up to the job?
With a resigned look, she nestled next to him. You're going to just hold me, she said. This time it seemed her command was not about the job. He grasped her shoulder and felt her tremble for a moment.
If you were not scared, you would not be doing it right, he said gently.
He'd begun to tell himself that they were making a connection when the recording stopped, and she abruptly threw the sheets off them.
Our time is up, she said, as she turned her back to him and began to get dressed.
Of course it is, he said.
USS Zumwalt, west of Alcatraz Island, San Francisco Bay.
Remember, just don't hit the bridge, said Executive Officer Horatio Cortez as the Zumwalt passed Angel Island to starboard.
2 cups of coffee ago, the ship had cast off from the pier at Mare Island for the first time since its overhaul. It was an anxious moment. Had it not been for the Mentor's crew's ease in handling the ship's lines, Simmons was pretty sure the ship would still be in port. The kids who'd helped refit the ship's systems had no idea how to get a warship underway. The Zumwalt had carefully processed from the shipyard at Mare Island down to Alcatraz Island, where it maneuvered to a very specific patch of the bay, just off eBay Park's pier. The highly anticipated visit was timed to coincide with a San Francisco Giants game against the Washington Nationals. The directorate well knew the Americans were refurbishing the ship by watching from above. They just didn't know any details. So the public rollout at the baseball game on a night when military personnel were given free tickets was billed as a morale booster. Secretary of Defense Marilyn Claiborne was even coming in to throw the first pitch. After her debut on the pitcher's mound, however, she was not going to the owner's private box, as most visiting dignitaries would do. Her next stop would be the Zumwalt's bridge, where they could use the night game at the park as a cover to test out the ship's new power systems. Pier 1, Honolulu, Hawaii, Special Administrative Zone. She actually had to fight for this one. At Local, a nightclub off Ala Moana Boulevard near Pier 1, Carrie nearly caused a brawl trying to get this Marine to dance with her. The Russian prostitute he was with looked like a junkie, and all it took was a discreet and well-placed foot to send her sprawling on the dance floor. Local security, off-duty directorate forces, whisked the prostitute out before she even had a chance to get back to her feet. It was her pimp that was the problem. He took Carrie for competition and grabbed her by the back of the neck to pull her off the dance floor. A roundhouse kick from her dance partner sent the pimp into a group of directorate sailors stuffing money and bills into a naked table dancer's scuffed white boots. After another close dance, she asked him to take her somewhere they could be alone. That turned out to be an 8-wheeled armored assault vehicle that looked exactly like one of the vehicles she used to see around her fiancé's airbase. Cocooned inside the welded steel hull, the two sat facing each other in the compartment that was big enough to carry up to 7 soldiers. A monitor's faint red light shone down from the opening of the wedge-shaped 105mm cannon turret above them. With the stench of sweat and stale food inside, the directorate Marine must have felt like he was trying to get laid in a dumpster, but apparently he didn't care. He turned his back to her and reached forward to the music player rigged between the front seats. She could see the muscles in his shoulders ripple, and looked at the 4 rainbow-hued tiger tattoos that covered his back and upper arms. His shaved head revealed a Morse code of scars, a lot for someone who couldn't be more than 25.
I have jazz, he said. Chinese okay?
Carrie laughed. Sure. Through the open rear hatch, she could hear the faint lapping of the water just beneath the pier where the vehicle was parked.
Your English is good, she said.
My parents made me learn since I was 2, said the Marine, for business.
Carrie raised a shot glass of the Baijiu
he'd poured for her. It tasted like shitty vodka. "To your parents," she said, "but this is not business. A thank you for your rescuing me. I think you should shut the door now."
"The hatch," he said, and squeezed past her to shut them inside the vehicle. The heavy steel and the layer of reactive armor affixed to the exterior suddenly made the soundproof space they shared feel very small. She climbed forward on all fours with a feline fluidity and straddled him. She still wore the black silk cocktail dress, but her high heels hung from a gear rack. He wore only the sheer black pants that seemed to be the directorate off-duty uniform for nightclubs and bars. The piano playing on the speakers was barely acceptable. It sounded kind of like Art Hodes, if he were a half-drunk robot and had a stim pump running on overdrive. Carrie's father had come from Gary, Indiana, in Chicago's shadow, and had taught her about the beauty of jazz and the horror of men. She kissed him, tasting only alcohol. Then she arched her upper body away from him. "Do you have any restraints?" she said.
"I'll do anything," he grinned.
"Of course you will," she said. "I mean like a rope."
"Can I record it for my feed?"
"This is for us, nobody else. No viz, okay?"
She leaned forward and kissed the nape of his neck and then his ear, careful to let her nipples move their way toward his face. "Over there in the bag," he said. "There should be something for prisoners. Careful." She pulled out a roll of fluorescent yellow nanopore tape used to bind wrists. It leached its bright color into the skin, creating a visual trace that announced you'd been nabbed. The substance was also rumored to be traceable by directorate sensors. In the red light, the tape glowed bright, and it unrolled silently as she began to bind his left wrist to the honeycombed aluminum base of one of the jump seats running along the interior of the carrier.
"Whoa, I thought we were going to tie you up," he said. "Are you scared?" she asked. "A big guy like you?"
She stepped back, tape still in hand,